Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where my guest today is Lisa Jewell, who's joining us from London. The one thing great about the pandemic, we can be with people all over the world. I had the pleasure of meeting Lisa a couple of years ago at Book Expo. We were talking about, then she was gone. We were having a whole conversation about this. And it's really funny because inside I found the interview questions because I actually went out and did an interview with her at Watchung Booksellers. So it's really funny when you take the book off the shelf and they're like, oh, look at the questions from when I chatted with her the last time. In between, I also loved watching you, which has got just a stunningly great cover. And today we're going to be talking about Invisible Girl, which I devoured last weekend. It was just page-turning fabulousness, and it's going to be a Book Reporter bets on. So delighted to have you here today. Thanks for joining us, Lisa.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for loving my book. That's a very good start.
It's a very good start to things, isn't it? Yeah. You know, you've talked in the past about how your writing is often influenced by something you see around you. And with this book, you saw a man on a street, and that inspired the start. So tell us about the man on the street who you saw.
So it was a snowy January afternoon. It was about 3 p.m. And I was walking through this part of North London where there's a lot of private schools. And all these little children had just come out of school at the end of the day. And, you know, there's not much snow in London. So children go a bit mad when it snows in London. And they were hurling snowballs at each other. And through all this throng of children and yummy mummies coming to collect them, this guy just appeared, this big, heavy set, lugubrious looking chap. And you could tell he was just so fed up with these children and these yummy mummies. And he just wanted to get from A to B, and they were all in his way. And there was just something about him that I kind of found fascinating. And I guess I got that feeling of like, what's it like to be him? What's it like to wake up every morning and open your eyes and you are him? And you have to live with that, and you have to make it work for you somehow. And then I just had this sense that I wanted to just get inside his head and just put him in a really awful situation and see how he reacted and see how dark he might get, because he had a darkness about him, I think, which is what appealed to me. And I just wanted to see if I threw enough stuff at him, how dark he would get and what he might be capable of. So yeah, that was the starting point for the whole book.
You know, I keep thinking, if you go back to that corner and that man walks by and say, here, there's a book. Yes. You inspired it. Let me tell you what you did for me that day. I think it'd be so funny, because this man does exist that inspired this whole thing, and just say, the book, it's all.
Yeah. And you know, the really funny thing is, if I saw him again, I wouldn't recognize him.
No.
I wouldn't recognize him. I just had he left me with a sense of himself rather than an imprint of his face. So I would walk up past him on the street now and I wouldn't even know it was him.
That's exactly right. I just love it. So from there, do you plot or do you just start writing your story? Do you have this feeling about this person and then go from there?
Yes. So I had this feeling about this person, and the first bad thing that I make happen to him is that he loses his job as a college lecturer because a couple of girls at college have accused him of behaving inappropriately at the Christmas party. So that was one starting point. I then thought I'd put him in a situation where he's living in a community where people look askance at him and find him a bit odd, and there would be some sex attacks happening in that area. I wasn't sure where I was going to go with that. I also put him in this part of North London that I lived in for a short while, a couple of years ago, while I was having my house renovated. It's a very, very upmarket area of North London, very leafy, very posh. I'd always wanted to live there and had the chance to live there temporarily, and hated every minute of it for various reasons, but mainly to do with atmosphere. So I wanted to set this story in this environment that I personally had found uncomfortable to live in. And then I thought, well, I needed someone to be the witness to this. I called him Owen, my guy. And so I put Owen living in his aunt's spare bedroom. on an uncomfortable single bed. It's very sad, and his aunt hates him. And then I needed someone to be witness to him. So that's when I decided I should have a family living opposite him who look at him and wonder about him and think he's a bit creepy. So I did a classic 2.4 kind of style family. So you got your mum, Kate, dad, Rowan, the teenage children, Georgia and Joshua. And I just had them feeling a little bit uncomfortable about this man across the street. The first chapter is actually Kate's daughter, Georgia, walking back from the tube station and thinking that Owen is following her up the road in the dark and being really scared. And particularly in the light of the fact there's all these sex attacks in the area. And then there's a third character in it who, ironically, given that the book is called Invisible Girl, and she is the Invisible Girl, Sapphire Maddox, and she came to the party quite late, actually. It was only going to be about Kate and Owen and their dynamic. And then there was a moment in the early chapters where Kate is looking through her husband. Her husband is a psychologist, a child psychologist, and she's looking through his private, not paperwork, because nobody has paperwork anymore, but through his personal affairs, and finds his notes on this patient that he had, this young girl called Sapphire Maddox, who he'd been seeing since she was 12 years old because she'd been self-harming. And for some reason, I just had this sudden, very strong feeling that I should be writing about her. She shouldn't just be a throwaway moment in the book. I really thought I would like to know who this Sapphire Maddox is. I would like to know why she's been self-harming. I want to know what happened to her when she was a child. And I want to know what her relationship was like with Kate's husband, Rowan, as his. So that's a very long-winded way of saying. Mm-hmm. I do apologize for going on and on and on, but it's actually quite a good way of explaining the book, of how it just kind of organically grows layers and layers and layers from one tiny little thing. So it's a matter of putting one thing in place and then thinking, well, if I put that in place, then I need something to look at that. And if I put that in place, then I'll need and then sometimes things just suddenly appear from nowhere and scream at you to write about them. So you make space for them. So the short answer to your question, Carol, is no, I don't plot.
We see this now.
You see this now. It was a very long-winded way of saying, no, I do not plot. I just keep going and keep going and just add things into the, it's like not following a recipe when you're making a cake and just sort of throwing things in and making the best of it and seeing where they end up and kind of using your instincts, really.
And I think having the voice of Sapphire be the voice the way you did it definitely enhances the story. It's sort of like if you're talking about a recipe, you found the right ingredient to totally, because when you see things from her point of view, not from an adult lens, yeah, it just lends something completely different to the story.
Yes, and I think it really needed it. I wasn't aware of how much it needed it until she arrived. And then I was like, okay, now we're rolling. Now it's all coming together. Because not only is she young, and she's quite, she's quite street, but she's also written in the first person. Mm-hmm. So that gives an immediacy to her presence on the page. And she's also the only, so the other two characters are very much living in the moment. We only find out about them minute by minute as their lives evolve, whereas she's talking backstory and about, how she got to where she is when we meet her at the very beginning of the book. So yeah, I think she was invaluable. What would we have called the book if she hadn't
called the book if we didn't have her there? It's interesting because I was thinking about which character I felt you enjoyed writing the most, and I thought it was her. And it was so funny that you say she came late to the story, because to me, I feel she gives a different energy to the book. She gives a wiseness to the book in a different way from everybody else. Was she your favorite to write?
Yes. She was my favorite to write because, like I say, there was that immediacy of using the first person. And often when I write in the first person, it's because I want someone to tell me who they are. Mm-hmm. So I was learning an awful lot about her as she was developed. But Owen, I really felt for Owen while mm-hmm. I was writing him. And I love writing characters. So it's clear from the get-go that Sapphire's a good guy. There's no dark areas with her or ambiguity. Whereas I loved writing the ambiguity with Owen and all the shades of grey you know, wrong-footing the reader, wrong-footing myself as well. And because, like I said at the beginning, I just wanted to throw so much stuff at him that he might break. Mm-hmm. But I was never sure where that breaking point might be, and I was never sure how far he would go. So Sapphire was much more sure-footed, mm-hmm. whereas Owen was just like, you know, was never quite sure how he was going to pan out. And there's a lot of excitement when you're writing a character like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what you're going to do with him. Yeah. You know, the other thing, Valentine's Day figures prominently into the story. It's a perfect holiday foil to write up against. It's got a fake charm to it, which Kate touches on so well when she's picking up the Valentine for her husband. And she's like, why am I buying this Valentine? Like, we didn't even know if we would still be together at this point. And it's that moment where you're standing in the store going, does this sentiment work? Do I really want to be saying this to him? And it seems like she's like a tad surprised she's still married to him. So the Valentine's Day, did that come to you right at the beginning of, oh, fake holiday, let's layer them all in?
No, actually it didn't. I didn't specifically set out, so most of the book is set in January and February. So it's very dark, it's very wintry, the days are very, very long. The days are very, very short. Mm-hmm. Because when I start writing a book, I just jump straight in at the deep end and just start writing chapter one. And I found myself just in January. And then the story developed and I thought, oh, hold on, it's February. Valentine's is coming up. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a deliberate thing. It was just like, oh, I could use that. I could write it's around about the time that someone might go into a card shop and try and find a Valentine's card for their husband. So I could write a scene about that and then we could get inside Kate's head and see how she feels about this sort of, like you say, this sort of fake, this sort of saccharine. I mean, I am very much not a fan of Valentine's Day. I can't bear it. My husband and I are adamantly non-romantic on Valentine's Day. So it was just a very good opportunity to write about what she was thinking about her marriage.
Yeah, because it's a moment where, gee, what do I want to say in this card? You know, it's funny, for Valentine's Day here, I make a heart-shaped cake every year. Like, there's this pan upstairs and I put whipped cream on top of it that's supposed to be pink and raspberries. And no matter what is going on, I am to deliver this cake. And we all talk about it and every single year. And I place the raspberries around it. And there doesn't need to be a card, but there needs to be the cake. And it goes on this plate that has little hearts on it, that has a chip in it, but it is still the plate that I use. And it's so funny, but that's Valentine's Day. Forget the card.
That's lovely. See, that is romance. That right there. And how many years have you been doing that for?
I'm trying to think, thank God, the boys were little. So it's got to be at least 10 or 12 years that the cake.
Oh, I love
it. And the big discussion is, do strawberries or raspberries get cut to go on the top of it? Like, which one is it going to be? And usually it's raspberries because they look even more amazing. So.
Yes. Oh, see, I love that. That to me is what Valentine's should be about.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, something, not this, you know, completely commercial thing.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, talking about love, there's this line where Sapphire is talking about with Roan in a therapy session where she said that love feels like a need. And it was such a great line. So she talks about a need and it's a very interesting idea. In fact, all the things they talk about in those sessions are very deep and it's giving you a lot of reveal about her, but it's also giving a lot of reveal about him at the same time. So therapy, was it something easy to be sitting and writing about?
No. And actually, you might notice, I don't know if you noticed, how little time we spend in those therapy sessions, because I wrote the first one so it's the first time that Sapphire goes for therapy with Roan. And I suddenly realized I was so out of my depth. I had literally no clue what would happen. And if I was another writer, the sort of writer who likes doing research, I live up the road from the biggest child mental health facility in the country. It's just there. I could just walked up to them and said, excuse me, do you think anybody would mind spending a little bit of time with me? Because I'm writing about a child psychologist. It's actually the place, it's the fictionalized version is where Roan works, of that exact place. But I don't do research. I don't like doing research. So I found myself writing this scene between Roan and Sapphire thinking, I have no idea. idea what I'm doing here. I do not understand how these sessions would normally work. Let's just wrap it up really quickly. I'm hoping in that time, and it is, I think, just one scene, in fact, mm-hmm. I'm hoping in that scene that we get enough. And I think it was quite compact, and I was quite pleased with it. But I thought, no, let's just stop now, quit while we're ahead.
Well, I pulled that line. So obviously,
because
I think she reflects on their session. She reflects on things that they've spoken about, but you're not back in that room. You know, it's so funny because Harlan Coben also does not do research. He said that basically he'll call his wife and say, on the way home tonight, can you see if there's a traffic light on that corner and let me know? He says, we're not leaving the house to go do that. And it's so funny because so many authors get completely obsessed with their research and they don't know what to leave in and take out. So yeah. I love that the place was right down the street, but I'm just going to keep writing.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I'm always terrified of things that stop me writing. Mm-hmm. Yes. The thought of having to break off for anything just sends me into a tailspin. So if I can find it on my computer, on Google, so much the better. I can break off for a few minutes and Google something. But if I thought, okay, that's going to be like, well, by the time I've actually made an appointment and spent some time with that person, am I, you know, then I, what am I going to do? Because I write sequentially. I don't sort of jump around.
Blank space, come back tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah, I do not like leaving blank spaces. I can't bear it. I just want to fill every page and keep going. So yeah. That's exactly why I don't do research.
So can you stop when you're writing? Like, do you have a certain time of day that you write and then, like, you're on a roll? You're on a roll with this. Do you stop or do you keep going?
I do stop because I'm an afternoon writer, because I find I can't start until my inbox is done, my social media is done, my housework is done, I've had my lunch, the dog's been walked. I have to get all those things done before I can start writing. So it's usually after lunch. My children, theoretically, my children come home from school, but at the moment they're on these stupid COVID timetables, which mean that they just keep walking in the house in the middle of the day or not having to leave the house until lunchtime. So I just seem to have children around the place the whole time. But theoretically, in a normal world, I stop writing when they get back from school. So it doesn't matter how good the flow is, I just stop. I don't like to write too much in a day, though. I don't like to write too much. 1,000 to 1,500 words is optimum. So I would probably stop anyway, even if they weren't coming home from school.
You just have to type a little bit faster when they're going to be home faster. It's like, oh, wait a second, open the door. Let me just keep going here.
Plodding
away, you know?
Yes. Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, you can write sort of three times as many words in the last 5 minutes as you wrote in the previous hour when you know that they're about to come home.
Well, Sally Hepworth has been, she lives in Australia, a thriller writer, and she's been writing in what she calls 350 word bursts, because she's got three children home. And one is like 2 or 3 years old. I think she's 3 years old. And she says that she's very happy to do 350 words, like lots of 350 words, but you can't do any more than that. The concentration's not the same.
See, I couldn't do that. I can't write in bursts. But I say that, we all get set in our ways eventually, us writers, after enough time. Maybe if my life changed and I found that that was all I had available to me, mm-hmm. I would do what Sally Hepworth does and write in 350 word bursts. But at the moment, it's set in my ways as I am. I can't imagine being able to do that.
Yeah. And they're teens. Your children are teens. That's a little bit.
13 and 17. Yes.
Yeah. They can go in and close their door. It's like, fine. It's fine. You know, yes. Owen in the book defines himself as an incel. And I had never heard of this, phrase before, who this is. What drew you to write about it and attribute it to Owen? And was it something you saw in the man on the street that inspired that?
Yeah, well, it's something I've always been fascinated by, because unlike you, I did know what an incel was. There was a blog post doing the rounds about a couple of years ago, and I cannot remember the name of the journalist who wrote it, but it was everywhere. It went viral. It was called The Rage of the Incels. And it was, she basically frequented these incel forums and then reported back in this very long article. And it was horrific. It's absolutely horrific finding out what these men talk about and how they
talk about women in these closed rooms. And there's also been a few terrorist attacks in the USA by men who frequent these forums as well. So for me, it was just one of those things that's always fascinated me, like cults. You know, my last book was about family upstairs. I've always been fascinated by cults, and I managed to shoehorn a cult into a book finally. And this was another thing. It's just something I've always been fascinated by, and I found an opportunity to shoehorn it in, rather than me sitting here going, you know, oh, what should I write my next book about? I know I'd like to explore the world of the incel community. It was much more like, ah, right. So we've got Owen. He's just been sacked from his job. He's feeling very hard done by, very angry and powerless. What would happen if Owen stumbled upon an incel forum? What would happen if he met a really charismatic man on an incel forum who might try to radicalize him? You know, this, so it was much more of a sort of organic thing, bringing it into the story. And actually, you say that Owen describes himself as an incel, and he actually doesn't. He kind of toys community, and to see if there's anything in that community that could help him feel better about himself, that could make his life better. Because, oh, this is something we haven't mentioned about Owen. Poor Owen is he's a virgin. Mm-hmm. He's 33 and he's terrified of women, and he's never had a girlfriend. And he's really, really bitter and twisted about the fact that, you know, he's not bad looking, and he looks around and he sees really unattractive men who've managed to get girlfriends, and he's really cross about the fact that he's alone and living with his aunt who hates him. It seemed the perfect experiment really for Owen. Like, what would happen if he found himself in a forum and, yeah, someone very powerful and charismatic tried to radicalize him? So yeah, it was interesting to write about. It's very dark stuff. Very dark stuff indeed.
So for our viewers, incel is exactly what? A person who defines themselves as an incel is?
They define themselves as an involuntary celibate. So they would like to be sexually active, but they are not sexually active because it's everybody else's fault. A society is stacked against them. Women are deliberately withholding their you know, bodily... Anyway, withholding themselves. Better looking men are cheating somehow. It's a very twisted way of viewing what used to be called unlucky in love. Has now become a political cause, which is why, yeah, on the odd occasion, it has been used as an excuse to go out and commit acts of terrorism. So that's it. It's an involuntary celibate. I do usefully put the Wikipedia definition in the book because I had a suspicion that not all readers would be familiar with what it actually was.
No, it was a beyond me.
Yeah.
You know, you also have this very different character, which seems to be this very tame fox that comes over and visits with, and it's just really crazy. Are foxes ever that tame that they would actually come up to people? Because the ones in my neighborhood don't look like they'd be hanging with me by the lawn chair.
No, it was supposed to be a little bit miraculous. It was supposed to be a wow moment. I mean, you know, I live in central London. There are foxes everywhere. And the minute they see you, they scarper, they're gone, they don't want to go anywhere. But you know, has that ever happened to you? You've been walking home in the night, in the dark, and a fox stops and stares at you, and you stare at the fox. Have you ever had that moment? And then they just turn and run. So I just sort of imagined what would happen if that fox, instead of turning and running, actually... So it was quite fanciful. It's not something that I mean, you can keep foxes as pets. There are people who tame them, but an actual street fox, an urban fox, no. I don't think that's highly likely, but I did enjoy writing about it.
And it did work with Sapphire. They were bonding. She and the fox were bonding. I love that. I absolutely love that little moment. You know, also Kate's got this daughter who's super spunky, and her son is this very sweet boy. I mean, this
Josh.
Son.
Oh, Josh.
He says goodbye to her all the time. He asks how she is.
Hugs her.
He hugs her.
He makes her a Valentine's card every year.
He never leaves the house without saying goodbye to her. And somehow during this book, she starts to start mourning that he's growing up. Like she starts to learn, like she opens this cabinet and learns things about him. Like, yeah. Oh my gosh, my precious little boy. Yes. And it's really funny because I think you hit on like a lot of what mothers feel like as their children are growing up. It's like, oh, remember when he used to do this?
Yeah.
Of course, I do joke that during the pandemic, no one says, I wish they were still little.
Yeah. Like, oh, remember during lockdown when they were home all the time. You know what? That was almost as fanciful as writing about a tame urban fox, because I'm absolutely the antithesis of that when it comes to my own children. They were just really... Both my girls were really painful from birth to teenage. I used to think I'm going to be well prepared for the teenage years because they've already put me through the ringer and they're only 5 years old, they're only 10 years old. So there's not one part of their childhoods that I would like to revisit because I don't have that sort of rose-tinted, like, oh, remember when they were three, remember when they were five. I just think back and, God, you remember what a pain they were. So I don't have that. So I loved writing about Kate. And also, I don't have a son.
Right.
So maybe I sort of romanticize the idea of having a son because I don't have one. But I loved writing about Kate's relationship with Josh. And yeah, it was just lovely, lovely. Whereas her relationship with Georgia is much more like my relationship with my girls. Was the word you use, ballsy?
Yeah, they're just saying, they're yes. Like, oh yes, this is what they're going to do. Yeah,
potty mouth, ballsy, bossy, stroppy, demanding.
And then, like, I'm going to make a cake. You have to get all the ingredients. Yes. I'm going to make it. I'm going to get the cravings for it. But yes. You're going to get all the ingredients, like right now. You know, and did you
exactly.
Get everything? Yeah. It's very, very funny. Yeah, but there's also this moment where I question Josh as a character, and I'm not going to give anything away. But yes. You definitely have this moment where you're like, wait a second, what is this boy? Like, you know, his mother's idolizing him in a lot of ways. Who is he really? And I think she learned some things about him, but we go in a different direction. I'm not giving anything more away.
No. I definitely left all the options open when it came to, I think, every man in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Without giving anything away, I wanted every character to be, in the frame.
Well, and Rowan is a very busy man. We'll just leave it at that, because this guy is just, and the excuses that he comes up to cover his tracks are like unbelievable. Of like, and she's kind of, Kate's onto him, but he's like so slick and so smooth that you could see how she's missed things because he's over the top.
Yes. Yeah, it was a strange marriage to write about. It really was, because I didn't want her to be too much of a wet blanket. I needed to keep her, you know, her instincts running and for her to keep questioning things. But at the same time, she does also feel, she did something bad the year before we meet her at the beginning of the book that gave him the moral high ground. And so that was a really interesting thing to write about, was in a marriage, it's very rare, sorry men out there, but it's very rare in a marriage for the man to have the moral high ground. Usually the woman. So when we first meet her, he's got the moral high ground and she's in this really weird position of not wanting to question anything or push him because she doesn't want him to be able to bring up what happened the year before and throw it back in her face because she feels so bad about what happened the year before. So it was a really weird dynamic to write about. It was fun though.
It totally goes back and forth. And you know, they're interesting. There are three sections of the book. There's before, after, which is most of the book, and then later, and then now. Wait a second, it's before, after, and then now, which is very brief, just a very, very short ending back there. Was it always written in those three different time frames or those three different sections, or did that come during the editing process?
Yeah, so I tend to, because I always, my books are always narrated by three characters, occasionally more, but it's usually three. And the way that my brain works in terms of like plotting on the page as I do is I find it's easier if I break the story up. So I do A character, B character, C character, A, B, C, A, B, C. And I wrote it that way. And then I gave it to my editor in the UK. And I think she thought it would be more powerful for the reader to get to know each character in depth before the thing happens on Valentine's night. So she just restructured it so that you get a load of chapters about Kate, a load of chapters about Sapphire and then Owen. But it had fundamentally, essentially been written in that way. So there's a prologue in which you're made aware that something bad has happened or is about to happen. Then there's a build up to Valentine's night. And then there's the aftermath of Valentine's night. And then, as you say, there's the ending. So it was essentially that format.
You know, and it's essentially that. And you know, sometimes when you sit there and you look at a book, you say, well, what happened along the way of the editing process of this? And I've heard you say you like editing. You like moving things around and doing that. Is there a moment where you know you're done, or as you're rereading the page passes, like before it goes to the printer, are you still sitting there going, you know what I would do here? Or is there a moment where you just say, I'm done?
Yeah, there is a moment I say I'm done. And this is how I know, actually, when you talk about the page passes, is because there'll be things that are preying on my mind after I've sent the copy edits back. And I think I'll fix that when the page passes come, I'll fix it then. And then the page passes come and then it's all typeset and it looks like a book and you kind of read it more objectively and you think, you know what? It's fine. It's typeset. It reads fine. I don't need to change that. So I think that is the point. It's not that I couldn't change it. You can change. Here's a technical factoid, is that you can change 10% of the text when it gets to the page proof stage without it causing lots of hassle for the typesetters. So you could change 10% of it, but I generally just think, yeah, it's good, let it go, move on.
But yeah, it's working. It's totally working. Yeah. You know, another thing that you mention in the book is, let me think, key lines are mentioned, which is something else I did not know.
Oh, ley lines.
Yeah. Ley lines.
Indeed. And that, interestingly, as I was saying earlier, when I lived in this smart area of London called Hampstead and thought I was going to have a ball and then hated it, I did wonder if... So I don't actually know what a ley line is. It's slightly spooky woo-woo stuff, really. I thought it might be something to do with burial sites or... I don't know, but it turns out it is literally spooky woo-woo. Some people believe that there are lines of energy running through the ground under certain places, and I think if they cross or something, I don't know. I never really worked out what a ley line was, but I did Google to find out if there were any ley lines under our temporary home in Hampstead, and there weren't. So there you go.
There you go. It was good. But I looked it up, and I have to say I was Googling last night, because when I was reading, I was folding down the pages, and that was one of the pages I folded down. I was like, what is a ley line? Yes. And I'm like, whoa, this is like really spooky. Where are these? And I think it's because it's close to Halloween and the wind's blowing. I'm like, need to look into these, you know?
Absolutely. It is. Yeah, it is a bit Halloween-y.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely, the whole year has been a bit Halloween-y.
Yeah.
With a mask.
12 months of Halloween.
Well, you know, it's funny because in our state here, the governor was saying, let's go over the rules for Halloween. And he's like, well, I don't know if the masks are protection enough. And I'm just sitting there like, we've been wearing masks since like March. Like really? Like, we're going to have a discussion now about, and Halloween was canceled a couple of years ago. We had hurricanes 2 years in a row. And as a result, Halloween was canceled. And we realized there were children like 5 that had no idea what Halloween was. Like, they'd never gone door to door. So they knew these rules about Halloween this year, that you shouldn't hand the candy to the child. It should be pre-wrapped. It should be not opening the door. It should be in a basket. And I was reading these rules the other day, and I was like, this is like absolutely crazy, because the favorite part is seeing the children, but you may not do that at all. No. They're just going to be receiving candy wrapped in a basket. It's very
funny. You may as well post it to them.
No, exactly. What I should really do is just drive around the neighborhood and put it in all the mailboxes and say, hi, it's from that woman. You know, over, yeah, it's absolutely crazy.
It's sad. So,
I saw in the acknowledgments that you type with three fingers, which I thought was like, you know, you're, because you're, I love that you thank yourself at the back of the book. Okay? I love this because I want to thank myself because I wrote the book. And I just love that because it's so true. But you said you and your three fingers. So there are which ones?
Okay. So it's mainly these two.
Okay.
And this one. This one ever so occasionally gets involved. But it's mainly these three.
Okay, so it's like pointer.
I think I wrote that acknowledgement after reading somebody else's acknowledgement, in which, you know, the amount of people who they brought into their writing process, who were helping and doing research and getting people to read and reread, and I just thought, I always thank the same people. I always thank the people who help after I finish writing the book, so the editors and the booksellers and the, you know, the readers and the bloggers and the, you know, whatever, librarians. I always thank the same people every time. And I did just think, is there anybody else I should be thanking, you know, apart from the people who helped get my book out there? And I just thought, no, it is literally just me. Just me and my funny old brain and my three fingers. Yeah.
Well, it's so funny you say that because I learned to type when I was 3 or 4 years old. My father had this little old metal thing and people said, you use the right fingers. And I was like, no, because my hand wasn't big enough to span because I was little. So I used to do the hunt and peck. I actually won the typing award in high school. But even now I use the correct fingers on my left hand, but on my right hand, it's always this finger and I'm all over and I type very quickly, but it's not like everything is and I won the typing award. It was like for speed and accuracy. And then they looked and they go, but you didn't use your fingers the right way. And I was like, really? Is that the point?
Does it matter?
It's just really, really funny. It's just really, really funny that, but when you wrote that, I was like, oh, I have to see what she does.
It is. My husband laughs anytime he watches me type. He just cannot believe that I function like that. And not only do I type really weirdly with three fingers, but I type really, really inaccurately as well. It's quite horrific. So when I hit a moment of flow, when the words are pouring out of me, which doesn't happen very often, but when it does, I look back at the screen, I'm like, whoa, what is that on the screen?
Right.
Is it Russian? What is it? I'm a terrible typist. And the irony being is I come from a family of secretaries. I was the only one, both my sisters and my mother are trained secretaries. And I'm the one who ends up typing for a living. So.
You end up typing for a living. This is what you do. It's just really funny because, and now, you know, I still think I haven't changed at all. Like, you know, did a computer change me? Did having a computer monitor, everything? Nothing has changed the way I write. Nothing, keyboard, nothing. Typewriter, keyboard, laptop, all the same way. So
still with that right finger.
really quick. And it was funny because this summer I got poison ivy. So I'm going to ask out in the garden between these two fingers. And I was like, thank God it's not this one. How would I be typing? What would I be doing? It's very funny. Very funny. Now you talked a little bit at the beginning that, you know, when you start your day, you do the social media, sort of the business of being a writer these days. Yeah. That's changed a lot since you started writing. I mean, it was changed a lot. How do you manage the business of making sure you're witty on social media and, you know, writing all these things all the time?
Yeah. Yes, I have basically turned it into a job. It's part of my day. I mean, it's not just the business of being a writer, but also the business of being a mother and a housewife as well. So these are all things I need to, you know, I don't have people to do these things for me. I do everything myself. So I just find slots for everything. And I found a really nice way of doing so. I used to think I could just do my social media on the go. Oh, you know, I could just, if I'm just sitting down for 5 minutes, I could do a bit of Twitter. But no, it doesn't work like that. The minute I've got 5 minutes to myself, I'm straight on the news website or on Facebook and and so I just kept getting behind with it. So I realized I needed to make a slot for myself. And how I make it really nice is because I do my social media on my phone, because emojis, because it's like 50% emojis doing social media. That's when I have my coffee. So I make a bit of a ritual out of it, and I make myself a coffee, and I take my phone, and I sit. If it's sunny, I'll sit in the garden. If it's cold, I might tuck myself up in bed or sit in the window seat or something, and I make it a little ritual out of it. So I do that every day. It's nice. It's just because I don't go on Twitter in the interim. I don't go on Instagram in the interim. So it's just like opening a door and going, oh, hi, everyone. And they're all there with the lovely messages. And, yeah. And it's just like catching up with everyone. It's just about finding lots of things, really.
And then responding to people, and then like, oh, wait, she's not going to be back till tomorrow. You know, like we're in a conversation. And then sometimes people ask me back, and I'm like, oh, wow, I haven't been there all day. I've been doing like life.
Yes. You know? Yes. And that's another thing. I think if I kept doing it all the time, I would reply to someone on Twitter, and then they would immediately reply to me. And then I would then reply to them. And there's something about just cutting it off. Mm-hmm. Of doing that, of acknowledging everyone and having that lovely interaction with everyone. And it is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, moving on and getting on. Getting on with writing a book.
Yeah. So you didn't have the girl, like Sapphire was not like there at the beginning. When did the title come in, Invisible Girl? When did that come in?
Yeah, so my working title for the book, given that Owen was the initial inspiration for the book, was Creep. Mm. Because that's what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about what it's like to be, you know, that's how people perceive Owen in his neighborhood. I think he's a bit creepy. And I knew that wasn't going to go. It doesn't sound like a Lisa Jewell book. There's a certain sound to my titles. Mm-hmm. And I knew that didn't sound like a Lisa Jewell book. So I knew that we'd have to come up with something else. Brainstorming. It's actually me that came up with that. I think I was doing the copy edits or something, and I realized I'd used the word invisible about 100 times in the book. And I just said, oh, what about Invisible Girl? Like, yeah, that'll do. Lovely. So,
yeah, no, it completely
came works. Very late in the day, the title.
No, but it completely works because you're wondering who she is the whole way, because she's hiding on so many levels. She's got so much depth to her, and she, and some, many times she's the smartest one in the room. I mean, let's get real.
Oh, without a doubt, she's so much the smartest girl. She's smarter than Rowan, and he's a blooming qualified psychologist, and she's so much smarter than him.
And the way she maneuvers her whole day, like maneuvers being outside in the night, and the way she can layer and convince everyone of what she's doing is just so well done. But she is invisible she's invisible because you almost don't see her. She doesn't see herself either. She's, except for the moments where she's cutting or hurting herself or whatever, she's sort of trying to figure out who she is at the same time. Yet she's super defined, but kind of be in the
but
background.
She's defined by other people. She knows how other people see her. And everybody just thinks, you know, she's incredibly attractive. She's 5'8". She's beautiful. She's incredibly bright as well. And she knows that that's how people see her. But she knows that that's not who she is inside. It's like beautiful on the outside, ugly on the inside. And that's who she's trying to come to terms with. And that's what she's trying to fix. And that's so she spends 3 years being a patient of Rowan's. And he thinks he's fixed her because she stops hurting herself. But what Rowan doesn't know is that he left what she describes as the tumor behind. The tumor being the thing that happened to her when she was a child that started this self-hatred, which leads her to, so the self-harming, obviously. Mm-hmm. But then after, when she's come through therapy and she stops self-harming, it turns into this weird form of claustrophobia where she cannot sleep indoors. Mm-hmm. She's just sort of, She needs to get rid of this tumor which Rowan left inside her, and that's obviously, you know, spoilers. We won't talk about what caused that tumor or how she excises it in the end. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's her journey, really.
Yeah, super, super powerful character. Super powerful. You know, covers. Your covers are different in each country, right? The like the different interpretations.
Yes,
because they're not exactly. I find that so interesting because you say.
Yeah.
I finish this and I think it's perfect. And then I'll see the UK cover and go, oh.
Yeah, that's it. It's not actually, that's the UK one.
I don't know where my American one's gone. So it's actually, I think they were thinking along the same lines, the designers, with this one, but quite often they're very, very different.
So
Then She Was Gone, for example, has got cherry blossom. Beautiful. The American cover's got cherry blossom on it.
Right.
Gorgeous. Whereas the one in England was, it was like a dark, wet pavement with like petrol-y puddles and a pair of feet. Could not be more different. So yeah, it is interesting. It's just different markets as well.
Different levels of appeal. You know, it was somebody, an author I know wrote a book years ago, and he did better in the UK than in the US because he wrote Child in Peril, and Child in Peril would play better there than in the United States. Nobody ever wanted the child in trouble in the United States.
This is the conversation I had with you, Carol, the first time I met you when I'd just written Then She Was Gone, and you were telling me about this. And I was saying to you, oh dear, the book I've just finished writing, or the book
I'm about to finish, reminded me,
has got a child in peril in it. Oh no, what am I? I've blown it for the American market. They're not going to like it. Yeah. And what did that book do last month? Did it get at number one in the New York Times? But yes.
I know. It was number one.
I remember you put the fear of God into me. It's like, oh no,
many
what have I
weeks.
Done?
Many weeks. It's been on the number one on Time. No, but it's funny because, and I think that book had actually been written, the one I was talking about, years before that. And it was like, how have we adapted to? How's the marketplace changed and what has happened to, just because of the world changing? But I do remember us sitting and having that conversation and you going, Carol, what did you just say to me? But hey.
Yeah,
obviously I was wrong.
Oh, I was terrified. I was like, that's it. I've blown my American career. Well done, Lisa.
Don't listen. But what are you working now? Your next book. Have you finished your next book? Are you working on your next book?
I am working on it. I am, how many pages? I think I'm about 250 pages in. And my books are usually about 350. So I'm over halfway, and yeah, that should be finished by the end of the year, and yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's good.
It'll be about the same time. It'll be out about the same time next year.
I think so. I don't know about America. It certainly will be out in the UK in August because I've already been told that by my UK publishers, but I haven't had a finalized publication date for America yet for my next book. Okay. But I would imagine it will be autumn, fall next year. I assume.
It's nice that you're on track because a lot of people have said they're super behind because they couldn't write for a couple of months. They were totally paralyzed on writing, you know?
Literally happened to me. Paralyzed is the word. I just couldn't. So I think I was only about 3,000 words into the book. I'd made quite a slow start on it when lockdown started over here. And I just remember thinking, but how can I write about people in 2019? How can I possibly form any connection to these characters who get to go to the pub or get to go and see their parents or get to, you know, kiss strangers or whatever it was? I just thought I can't put myself there. It just felt so alien to me. And I thought, oh, what am I going to do? And people were talking around the beginning of lockdown. They were talking about, oh, are you going to write a you can start writing dystopian novels now, or it was just, no, I don't want to write about this either. I can't write about these people being normal in 2019. I certainly don't want to write about people being weird in 2020. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what am I going? I don't know what to do. And I did that sort of, as a lot of writers did, that just sort of, as you say, paralysis of, I literally don't know what to do with myself. I'm just going to just watch the news for today. And then I just realised that this lockdown isn't stopping anytime soon. This is going on and on and on. And I've got a book to write and I've been paid for it. And I just need to get on with it. So I just got on with it. Caught up with myself pretty quickly.
Put everything else aside. I was talking to somebody the other day because everything started to happen here in about mid-March, right? Yes. So she said that, it was funny, she said, when we left the office, I thought they were going to clean it over the weekend and we'd be back on Monday. She goes, and then I figured I'd be back by Easter. And then I thought Memorial Day and summer. And then I thought the fall. And she says, what are you thinking right now? I said, next fall is what I'm thinking. And she's like, really? And I was like, I don't know, sort of the way the cars are aligning to me, that's what I'm thinking, it's next fall. But I could be wrong, like child in peril, but I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I just sat there going, because everybody kept saying January 1st. You know, yeah. Everything's going to change on January 1st. And I said, the only thing that's going to change is it's not going to be 2020 anymore. I exactly. don't see something magical happening on New Year's Day. So it's very funny.
Yeah, no, it's not exactly. It's not, nothing's going to happen just because it's 2021. There is a nice rare 2021. When I think of 2021, I think I have a spark of hope, but it's certainly not going to happen on January the 1st. I think you might be right about another year, but ugh.
But you know what people keep saying?
It's so depressing.
Remember how they said, is 2020 really the start of the decade? Maybe it's 2021. Maybe we should go with that.
Yes.
Maybe the whole thing is we all say, part of the new decade. Maybe we better just move it back a year, you know?
I like that. Yes.
We'll
I like that.
That.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you found your three-finger writing style again. I'm glad you're in the zone. It's like wonderful because I look forward to seeing what you do next. This is absolutely so well done because there's so much to think about, and the plotting, even though you did not plot ahead of time, is so tight and so good. I would sit there and say, oh, she had her pink card and her blue card for moving things along with tension and this. No, obviously not.
No, just a head going, woo, woo, woo.
Well, it completely woo, woo, wooed worked. So, as always, it's great to see you. I look forward to doing it again with the next book because obviously I'll just stick the notes inside so I'll know for next time what we chatted about.
I love that. I love do it the minute we finish filming, put the notes in.
Yeah. Those are going in the book, books going on the shelf.
Excellent. I love it.
So, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so glad we had time to do this.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. I always love talking to you, Carol. Really do. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
And to our readers, we look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks so much for joining us. Keep listening for an audio excerpt of Invisible Girl by Lisa Jewell, narrated by Donna Banya, Catherine Kelly, and Connor Swindles, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Emily Dankies. And now, hear an audio excerpt of Invisible Girl, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio.
He sees two amber dots glowing in the dark, a fox staring at him. Hello, Foxy, he says into the darkness. Hello, beautiful. He glances across the street. There is a light still shining in one of the windows. He sees the suggestion of movement behind it. He hears raised voices coming from somewhere out of sight. Then he sees a person standing outside the house, tall, slender, in a black hoodie, tips of angular elbows protruding from their sides like wings. The person stands for just a moment, watching the light in the window just as he does. Then the person turns, and in profile he can see it as a young girl, her hands stuffed into the pockets of her hoodie, her jaw set hard. As he watches her, she turns and looks at him. I know you, he thinks. I know you.